Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Vicky Gonzalez is off today. This week, an advisory group to the Food and Drug Administration recommended the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine be authorized for emergency use in kids aged 5 to 11. According to the LA Times, state officials say they are preparing to offer doses to the roughly 3.5 million children in that age group by the end of next week. State epidemiologist Dr. Erica Pond says this move will get us closer to ending the pandemic. With us now to answer some of your questions, because I'm sure there are some, regarding the addition of younger children to the vaccination list is Dr. Dean Blumberg. He's the chief of pediatric infectious diseases at UC Davis Health and a regular voice here on Insight. Nice to speak with you again, doctor.
Good morning, Randall. How are you?
Good, thank you. So with what you know about the study of the Pfizer vaccine on kids, are you confident about the safety of it in this young population?
Yeah, I am. It's a very small dose of the vaccine, and the children have a very robust immune responses. The side effects that we're seeing were similar or less compared to the older children, the 12 to 15-year-olds. And there's no reason to think that there would be any surprises in terms of side effects in this age group.
You mentioned a smaller dose. The Pfizer dose for this 5 to 11 group is what, about a third of what the adults are getting?
Yeah, instead of a 30 microgram dose, it's 10 micrograms. And the younger children have a more robust immune response. So you can get away with giving that smaller dose. It's really small. It's like about a sixth of the weight of a grain of salt.
And they have smaller bodies, too. Does that make a difference?
It might make a difference, but I think it's mostly the immune response, that the immune systems in children are stronger. And as we age, our immune systems weaken.
How about concern over heart inflammation? What should parents know there?
Yeah, it's been really interesting because obviously that is a concern. It's a very rare side effect in the children, the 12 to 15-year-old children. However, it's important to put this into context that we know that COVID can cause myocarditis or pericarditis, inflammation of the heart. And if you do a risk-benefit analysis, there's no question that it's clear that if you want to prevent myocarditis or inflammation of the heart, the numbers don't lie. The chances of getting that are much higher if you're not vaccinated and the increased risk of COVID compared to being vaccinated.
Just laying everything out there in addition to the heart inflammation, are there any other side effects that doctors are expecting that parents really should know about going into this?
It's really the routine side effects that we've seen in the older age groups, fever, pain at the injection site, fatigue, chills, things like that. But again, they do appear to be less frequent in this age group compared to older individuals.
Being at such a major children's hospital for the entire region, do you have any sense of how soon younger kids in the Sacramento area could start receiving these vaccines or this one vaccine by Pfizer?
You know, as early as next week, Pfizer says that they are taking orders as of Monday of next week, and they will start shipping Tuesday or Wednesday. So we need to get these specific pediatric formulations into offices and at vaccination sites in order to get children vaccinated. So I would think at the end of next week or the following week, we should have vaccine available.
In the past, Dr. Blumberg, before COVID, you have advised parents who have been hesitant about giving their children required vaccines for schools. There's a whole list of them. How do you work with concerned parents or guardians to make them feel more comfortable in these situations?
You know, it's really different, and it's all the same, too, compared to the previous vaccines. Well, there's more experience with the other vaccines. So one of the extra layers of hesitancy is that the newness of these vaccines. And yet, you know, there's a robust safety experience with them. More than 6 billion doses have been administered worldwide. And so I think the most important thing is that there's a lot of rumors out there. There's conspiracy theories out there. And parents should go to somebody that they trust and get information. And everybody has unique concerns. And so that's why it's not a one-size-fits-all. People should talk with their healthcare provider, their pediatrician, and a trusted healthcare advisor is what I recommend.
I assume that you're hearing from parents at work and also in your personal life. What are you hearing? Is there a desire to get their kids vaccinated against COVID, or are you sensing more concern?
You know, I hear it both ways. One is that parents are tired of their children homeschooling. They're really happy to have in-person learning available again, but they are concerned that as they go back to school, that that increases the risk of their child getting COVID and them bringing it home and infecting others. And so many parents are really anxious to get their children vaccinated. And then there's those parents who may have heard that COVID is a lower risk for severe disease in young children compared to adults. And then it's important for those parents to realize, although it's lower risk for severe disease, that's not no risk. And we know that in the US, there's been 1.8 million cases of COVID in children 5 to 11 years of age, more than 8,000 hospitalizations and 94 deaths in this age group. And in fact, in children, COVID is the ninth leading cause of death in the U.S. currently. So it's something to take seriously.
Yeah, I want to talk about some cases maybe that you've seen personally in your work. Can you describe how COVID affects these children?
Yeah, so in terms of acute COVID infection, I've seen it in all ages, from kids getting infected in the first week of life to teenagers. And the ones that are most sick that I've seen have been teenagers. Commonly, their risk factor for severe disease is obesity, and they can end up in the ICU on ventilators, sometimes on heart bypass machines because their lungs are not able to provide enough oxygen. Mm-hmm. And they can be really sick. And then the other category of really sick kids is the kids with the post-infectious complication, MIS-C, the multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. This occurs 2 to 4 weeks following acute infection. And these children can be scary sick with high fevers and very low blood pressures, often required ICU care. And fortunately, we do have treatments available for them, and the vast majority of them do recover.
Doctor, do we know yet whether being vaccinated can help prevent transmission of the disease? I would imagine that that would be an argument for getting the younger kids vaccinated.
Yeah, the primary reason to vaccinate them is to protect them personally. But a secondary benefit of having children vaccinated is to decrease transmission. The vaccine in the 5 to 11-year-olds was 91% effective at preventing acute symptomatic COVID infection. And so therefore, if there's less infection, then naturally there will be less transmission. And we've seen that in other age groups also, that asymptomatic infection is less among those vaccinated. And even when that does occur, there's less transmission compared to asymptomatic infection in unvaccinated individuals.
A year ago, you couldn't turn on the news without hearing the term herd immunity. That has faded a bit, but how does this move to approve children 5 through 11 move us any closer, if at all, to potential herd immunity?
Yeah, well, I'm glad we're not talking as much about herd immunity, because I think we're not really going to get there totally, because what we're going to have is we're going to have endemic COVID infection. And the idea is we want to make sure that people have enough immunity so that when cases are introduced into the community, that there aren't the severe infections that result in hospital admission and ICUs being overwhelmed that we saw in Italy early in the pandemic, New York City, Iran, and India. If we can get partial immunity, then when these breakthrough infections occur, then they'll be mild disease. It'll be outpatient disease. And getting children vaccinated, the 5 to 11-year-olds, there's 28 million of them in the U.S. That accounts for 8% of the population. So that we can make a good dent in getting more people immune to really limit transmission.
And by endemic, you mean that we will always deal with some sort of COVID risk in our everyday life, but more like the seasonal flu.
Yeah, more like the seasonal flu. That's how I see our post-pandemic future, in that we deal with the seasonal flu. We accept that. We don't like it. But every year, we get waves of influenza, and we take a risk of getting an outpatient disease, maybe being in bed for a couple days with fever and chills. The vast majority of people recover and don't need to be hospitalized. And during a bad flu season, some people may choose not to be in crowded places, but nothing's closed. There are no lockdowns and there's no mask mandates. And so that's what I think we'll see in terms of a post-pandemic world.
Doctor, what would be your guidance regarding masks in schools following this new round of younger children being vaccinated?
right now, I think we need to have masks in school in terms of to limit transmission. We'll see if we can get a high enough vaccination rate among students, staff, and teachers. Maybe in the future, we won't need to do masks in school. But right now, schools are relatively crowded places. They are not, they really don't have the physical capacity to have children social distance. So I think for the foreseeable future, meaning like for this winter, we're going to have masking in schools. And then hopefully next year, maybe in the summer and next respiratory viral season, maybe we won't need that anymore.
And might this help keep schools open for in-person instruction?
Well, that's the idea, is that the more people that are immune, the less chances of transmission will occur in school. If there's less outbreaks in school, then it keeps those schools open, keeps children in school. And that's so important for their mental and physical health.
So I know your focus is on pediatrics, but you know a lot about these shots and about the disease in general. So there is also big news about booster shots for the larger population. Federal officials say people who originally got the Moderna or Johnson & Johnson vaccines can now get boosters, and it's okay to mix and match. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the mixing and matching has been done with other vaccines too, and almost all the studies suggest that getting different vaccines from different manufacturers does result in a more robust immune response. So I think it's a good idea, but we actually had to have the studies in place in order to make those recommendations. And last week, these studies were presented to the FDA, and they looked good. The mRNA vaccines look like they do result in a more robust immune response compared to Johnson & Johnson. So in general, that's what I'd recommend, except for certain populations. And then the boosters, we do get waning immunity. The fortunate thing is for the vast majority of people, for those less than 65 without underlying health conditions, that waning immunity just results in mild outpatient breakthrough infections, whereas it doesn't result in increased risk of serious infections that result in hospitalizations. That's different for those over 65 years of age or those that are at higher risk for serious disease, and they definitely should get boosters.
I've heard recommendations several times now that if you got the Johnson & Johnson shot, it is advantageous to get either the Moderna or the Pfizer shot as your booster. What about the reverse? What if you were a Moderna or a Pfizer person? Does it make sense to go the other direction and get Johnson & Johnson as your booster?
Yeah, the titers that you get following the Johnson & Johnson booster, if you're primed with the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines, they're lower. And so you do get a higher antibody response. Now, we don't have an absolute cutoff for that antibody response to correlate with immunity. But in general, more antibodies is probably going to result in more immunity for longer lasting immunity. So if you want to be more protected, then get the Pfizer or Moderna for your booster. But getting any booster results in a really robust immune response.
Would you call the boosters and the authorization for the younger kids a game changer?
I don't think the boosters are a game changer because we still have persistent immunity against severe disease in the vast majority of the population. But getting it into younger kids, making sure that they're eligible for vaccination, I'm excited to have them protected. I see these kids in the hospital. I see these kids in the ICU. I want them protected, and I want parents to have peace of mind when they send their kids back to school.
Finally, Dr. Blumberg, some say that we shouldn't be getting boosters here in the U.S. until the rest of the world has had a chance to get their first shots. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, the most important thing for everybody worldwide is to get some sort of partial immunity. So getting even one dose for the vast majority of the population, that's going to provide the best protection for the greatest number of people. Getting two doses is even better. And again, the boosters, they're most important for those over 65 years of age or with underlying conditions, and they're much less important for everybody else.
Because so long as it's spreading, it can mutate, and we can deal with Delta surges and whatever Delta is in the future.
Right. So the Delta variant is so much more infectious compared to the previous strains. But the more it multiplies, the more transmission there is, the more opportunities there are for additional mutations, additional variants, and they can get worse.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Dean Blumberg is chief of pediatric infectious diseases at UC Davis Health. I always learn so much from you. So thank you for making time for us this morning.
Great. Thank you.
Up next, California officials now say fraudulent EDD payments during the pandemic total an estimated $20 billion. Cap Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon joins us with those developments. Also, an employment law expert gets us up to speed on the latest pandemic challenges. You can join the conversation with your employment questions. Email us. It's easy. Insight@capradio.org. Or you can also use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. And you are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio in Sacramento. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Vicky Gonzalez is off today. So the California Employment Development Department, or EDD, has been riddled with issues that were amplified by the pandemic, like, for instance, the agency's aging software. Well, over the past 18 months, we have brought you coverage about the EDD's long hold times, the issues people have faced in trying to apply for unemployment insurance, website lags, and tips on how to navigate the entire system. In January, the EDD reported about 2 million cases had been flagged as fraudulent. 2 million cases. And now this week, an estimate came out showing that $20 billion, billion with a B, worth of fraudulent unemployment claims have been paid out. In addition, the backlogs are still a problem. As of this week, there are roughly 119,000 such cases still awaiting action by the EDD. The state has new recommendations for how the department can clear up its issues. And here to break down how it's all going is Cap Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon. Nicole, always a pleasure to chat with you.
Good morning.
Yeah, so there was an oversight hearing back on Monday, which was originally scheduled for August. Remind us why that was then rescheduled.
Yeah, you know, lawmakers at the time this hearing was first canceled in August, they said that, you know, they were trying to coordinate several different legislative committees for this hearing, and it just didn't work out timing wise. This was in late August. This was at the end of the legislative session when things get really hectic for state legislators. You know, but they also around that time canceled an oversight hearing on wildfires that was prompted by an investigation by our colleague, Scott Rodd, that found that Governor Gavin Newsom had really overstated progress on fire mitigation projects. And that has not ever been rescheduled, you know, as far as I know. And, you know, these cancellations were just a few weeks before the recall election right. against Newsom. So there were grumblings that Democratic lawmakers didn't want to have the Newsom administration in the hot seat, you know, answering all these tough questions. But lawmakers said in both cases it was just a timing issue. But I will also point out that for this EDD hearing that took place finally 2 months after it was originally scheduled, there wasn't a huge turnout. There were maybe 6 to 8 lawmakers in this hearing between, you know, 2 or 3 different committees.
Mm-hmm. So now the state auditor says the EDD has implemented 2/3 of the recommendations that were given back in January. What were those? What were those recommendations?
Yeah, overall, there were 21 recommendations from this audit that was released in January. And since that time, you know, 10 months later, the EDD has implemented most of these. These recommendations range from issues with the call center to claim processing to fraud detection, which were all major problems over the course of this pandemic. Specific recommendations include things like, you know, establish a new fraud detection and prevention unit. This is underway right now. There were also some things that I think most people were surprised to learn were not a thing at the EDD, like the ability to call and leave your phone number and request a call back. You couldn't do that. And that's why we heard so many complaints of being of people being kept on hold for hours and hours. Also having an email for victims of identity theft to, you know, send an email, say, here's my information. I think I'm a victim of identity theft. And I'll also say that the legislature passed a handful of bills this year that require some changes at the EDD, things like requiring them to cross-match their data with state and local corrections departments to ensure that unemployment checks aren't being made out to incarcerated people. Also to develop a recession plan so that we aren't seeing these same issues in the future, which is a huge worry for lawmakers.
Mm-hmm. Are there examples or any data to show whether some of these changes have helped?
Yeah, the agency's director, Rita Sein, says that they have helped, that, you know, right now the agency is more efficient and more secure. But she said that many of these issues stem from really big structural problems like the very old computer systems that the department uses.
Mm-hmm. So just to jog the memory, because there's been, you know, so much news for the past 18 months. You may recall there were issues with legitimate claims where a Bank of America issued debit card was frozen and claimants couldn't then use their unemployment funds. Where are we in terms of issuing direct deposit so that people don't have to rely on checks in the mail or these cards that aren't connected to their actual bank accounts?
Yeah, direct deposit is something that, you know, probably anybody who's used unemployment or gotten help through EDD really wants. The director, Rita Sines, told lawmakers it's still a couple years off to do direct deposit. They would have to set that up. It could take some time. But also, the EDD just a few months ago renewed its contract with Bank of America to continue dispersing unemployment funds on those debit cards for another 2 years. And this has really been a point of frustration among lawmakers because, you know, California likes to think of itself as on the cutting edge technologically, but this debit card system became so antiquated so quickly, and it's really ripe for fraud, as we've seen.
You would think maybe there was a mind or two in Silicon Valley that could lend some helping ideas on how to change that. You mentioned, or you referenced the decades-old software. How much of a contributing factor, or do we know how much a contributing factor it was when it came to all of these pandemic-related problems?
I mean, it's huge. It's basically the root of all of these problems. The programs that the EDD systems run on are decades old, and it's part of the reasons that it takes so long to process these claims. EDD officials have said that it would take a long time to completely overhaul the systems, but, you know, they also said that back in 2013 during a recession when we were seeing some of the same issues that we're seeing now. And we do have to mention, you know, that EDD's workload really exploded in spring 2020 because of the pandemic. Just a huge crush of claims, more than they were ever used to dealing with. And even without these tech issues, it would have been overwhelmed. So, but, you know, these slow and glitchy systems have made it such a long slog for them to process.
We're seeing employee turnover everywhere right now. How has turnover at the agency affected the customer service aspect of all these issues?
You know, I think, you know, if you talk to anybody who's dealt with EDD, the customer service aspect has not been good. The agency says that it's had turnover of about 30% at its call center. It sounds like a lot, but Director Rita Sein says that that's, you know, right on par with other call centers. Oh. However, the EDD, it can take up to 4 months to onboard and train new employees. So backfilling that employee turnover is really slow.
Mm-hmm. Nicole, I want to shift gears just a bit here before we let you go. Later today, there's a hearing on potential plans to change how recalls are handled in California. This, of course, comes in the wake of this year's failed effort to recall Governor Gavin Newsom. What's expected at this hearing today?
Yeah, people... since the recall, people have been talking about, you know, some of the problems with it, the threshold to get a recall on the ballot. Some believe that recall organizers should have to gather more signatures. There's also this issue where a governor or any elected official really could get 49 support in a recall and therefore lose their job, but then be replaced by a candidate who gets fewer votes, like 20%. Those are some of the main issues. There are other ideas floating around about how the recall process could be improved. So lawmakers are basically having hearings to hear from experts, talk about how this works in other states, and maybe get ideas for how California's recall could be improved. This will be the first of 2 to 3 hearings over the next few months. And I talked to Assembly Member Mark Berman. He's chair of the Assembly Elections Committee. He said they plan to introduce a bill early next year. Any major changes to the recall process would require a constitutional amendment. So that means that 2/3 of lawmakers would have to support it, and then it would go before voters. So we could be voting on recall procedure changes this time next year.
Wow. Which is already, you know, a big midterm election anyway. So, yeah. All right. Cap Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon. You know, I think you're the best.
Thank you.
All right. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio, and we're going to bring in Jennifer Shaw, an employment legal expert with the Shaw Law Group in Sacramento. For transparency purposes, which we like to be very transparent here at Cap Radio, the Shaw Law Group is a financial supporter of the station, but has no editorial influence on programming. To be completely honest, we've invited Jennifer back time and time again during the pandemic because she's just so good at boiling down employment issues and making them digestible on the radio. So, Jennifer, welcome back. It's really great to speak with you again.
Thank you so much, Randall. It's so great to be here.
Yeah. So what is the status of the EDD's progress in implementing the recommendations that Nicole just talked about?
Well, Nicole did a great job, of course, summarizing what those 21 items were that the state auditor told the EDD to do. And just to be clear, the EDD agreed at that time that they would do all of them. They did not dispute any of the recommendations that the state auditor put together because, and offered.
Because sometimes departments or agencies will say, and this just happened within the last week, they'll say, we disagree with your report. In this case, the Employment Development Department said, you're spot on, and we're going to make these changes.
Absolutely. And that was really to their credit, because there has been just so many problems for so many years with the computer programs, with the hardware, with the personnel turnover, with trying to get people trained to do what needs to happen. And the pandemic, as we all know, was unprecedented. So the workload for the EDD went crazy, went ballistic. And even if they had had the most perfect system in place, it would have been a challenge. Mm-hmm. But without that, it was a big deal. So they freely admitted, yes, we need to make changes. And I think the progress that has been made since that report was issued back in January is really significant. It's something that I think the EDD should be really recognized for taking the steps that they've taken. Now, the problem is, of course, that doesn't change somebody who is just trying to get their benefits. Now, one of the things that's happened since you and I spoke last time was they're taking the position in many of these cases, the EDD is actually allowing people to get their benefits before their right to the benefits has been confirmed. Because what they're saying now is it's 4 months for them to have an interview where they can confirm somebody's eligibility. So rather than making them continue waiting, they're paying those benefits up front.
And then does that lead to the $20 billion in fraud that we're hearing about?
Well, that's a little bit of a problem. It's certainly part of it. The other thing that I worry about just as a one-off is that people are getting money that they need that they're spending, and then there may be some technical reason that they're not actually entitled to those benefits, and they're going to have to pay them back. So there's a pro and con to everything, of course. I love the idea that they're letting people access the benefits and not wait the 4 months, but I am telling folks who ask me for advice, look, if you need the money, which I'm sure you do, spend it, but just don't be surprised if there's an issue down the road. And many times there's an issue that's not really an issue. There's, for example, a social security number that was input incorrectly, or somebody gave their dates of employment and it looks like they're not eligible, but there was a typo. So the EDD is doing a good job once they have the interview with the employee or the employer to clarify what's gone wrong or what the issues are. They're correcting those a lot more quickly than they used to. So the folks who receive the benefits are going to know pretty quickly whether they're okay or they might have to pay them back.
Asking you the question about the fraud and whether giving people access to this money early could be exacerbated by that. I don't even want to ask that question because there are so many legitimate people that need that money, and fraud makes me angry on every level, but that there are people out there that would take advantage of EDD, and then there's a side harm to these people who really need this money just to get by, and it's just disgusting, to be honest.
We share that frustration, Randall. It makes me so upset because I know there has to be focus on the fraud. Certainly, we don't want to be giving away millions of dollars. And I totally get that and I understand it. But I think the vast majority of people who are applying for these benefits, they're entitled to them. They need them. And I think this pandemic work history problem, benefits, paying our mortgage, all of that, it's lasted a lot longer than people thought it would. Mm-hmm. And maybe some of us were, for me, for sure, I think I was a little bit overly optimistic about how quickly we could sort of get back to normal. But there are people who've been out of jobs for, you know, a year and a half. Now, one of the things that comes up, Randall, that I think we have to talk about is everywhere you go right now, there's a help wanted sign.
Right.
And unlike initially, when the pandemic struck, where the EDD said, look, we don't need proof that you're looking for a job because guess what? There aren't any. People are closed. They're not hiring. You're not going to get a job. You don't have to show us proof of a search.
But now there are jobs.
Changed. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That changed in the summer because there are so many jobs. So one of the things that I think our communities are dealing with is the psychological effect of this isn't a job I used to have. This is a job that I might be, quote, overqualified for, but there are jobs out there. Mm-hmm. And I have friends and colleagues who have taken jobs that are much less than they could have been paid, much fewer responsibilities than pre-pandemic, but they need a job. So we're going through this huge transition as a society, I think, in terms of what jobs are out there. Many, many more people are now going the route of, look, let's be an Uber driver. Let's start my own business. So we're seeing a huge change in the economy at the same time. So I think that's also exacerbating the frustration that people have about getting the benefits. When are the benefits going to be gone? So there's just a lot going on there.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to chatting with you because there's been so much coverage of this great resignation, as they call it. So what is your advice for somebody who's thinking about taking this course, you know, quitting the profession they're in because they're not happy with it? The fact is you cannot collect unemployment if you quit, right? Or do I have that wrong?
Well, not generally. If you quit because somebody is sexually harassing you or you've been the victim of workplace violence, for example, you can get the payments from the unemployment folks that will work from the EDD. But if you've just decided, hey, the pandemic has resulted in me questioning, you know, what I'm doing on this planet and I want to go do something different, you're not going to get any unemployment for that. So I'm sort of a fiscal conservative personally. So I feel like, look, don't jump ship until you know you've got what you need. So I have folks who are family friends who decided to quit their job one day and, you know, go on a big van trip across the country, or they're surfing in Costa Rica, they're doing other things. That's great. But for me personally, you know, I would need to know that I had my little nest egg there. So I tell folks, look, the first thing you have to do is just think about reality. Okay. Do you have enough in the bank? We have inflation right now, which is something that we need to think about as well. Mm-hmm. I can't believe how much my grocery bill has gone up. You know, a noticeable difference, not to mention gas, of course, which we see on every street corner as the prices go up. So part of it is, I just want people to think about, don't assume you're going to get the perfect job at the end of this process. Really do some soul searching. Can you downsize? Can you reduce your monthly obligations? Because our clients, our employers, they're hiring, but they may not be hiring to do what you want to do. My 11-year-old told me the other day, Mom, I don't think I want to work as much as you do. And, you know, but I want to make sure I have enough money that I can go on vacations like we do. And I had to explain, hey, I get it, sweetie, but there's sort of a correlation there, right? You're going to have to know what you can live with and how you can move forward. Now, I will say, I'm very proud of employers right now. They are really thinking about how to retain their good employees. And I'm also telling them, hey, the great resignation is good news for you in some ways as well. You're going to have an influx of people who want new jobs.
Yeah.
Some of them are going to go to Costa Rica, but some of them actually just want another job, right? So let's think about, what can we do to draw people in? What can you offer as benefits?
Jennifer, did you tell your 11-year-old, hey, mommy is also planning for the future a little bit?
Yeah, I had to mention, you know, college, retirement.
Right.
You know, it's just so funny to have a kid's perspective of what's going on. And so many things she's just right on about. Look, you can't, you know, live to work. You really should work to live.
Yeah, and there's a little 11-year-old in all of us that we're thinking exactly what your daughter was saying. Hey, I want to jump back to the EDD quickly.
Yes.
So Nicole mentioned it could take a few years before these direct deposits begin. And for those of you who can't see Jennifer, she's putting her hands on her head and just shaking in disbelief. What are your clients saying about their ability to access the benefits?
Well, many of the employees who need them, the former employees, they're getting them. And I'm getting a lot of anecdotal information. Jen, it's going a lot more quickly. I'm not getting all these crazy letters that don't make any sense that are, you know, auto-generated. People are actually calling me back. I mean, remember, when we started talking about this issue, Randall, the EDD was answering 1% of the phone calls.
1%.
1%. And so now they're, you know, they've hired hundreds of people to work in the call centers. They're trying to get them trained more quickly. People are getting the benefits. I think one of the most surprising things for folks is when they go into their system on the EDD, there will often be money that looks like they should be able to access that's left over from the federal programs that ended.
Oh.
So a lot of people are calling me saying, but Jen, it says I'm entitled to $3,700 in benefits. Well, if that was the federal benefit, it's over. It's still in your account. You're going to see it, but you're not going to be eligible to get it.
Mm.
And that's created a lot of confusion. So the EDD is working on that as well.
In the past, you have said to people who were getting disheartened by the process of contacting the EDD and going through all the steps, you've said, stick with it. It's worth it. That was sort of your mantra a year ago. Is that still your mantra?
Absolutely. I feel so strongly. We pay into this system. You deserve to get the benefits to which you are entitled. I've had people say, well, it's not that much money. Well, it's something. It's something that you're not going to have to go generate somewhere else. And by the way, we have some of the highest monthly benefits in the entire country. I realize we also have a very high cost of living. So in no way am I saying that the benefits are enough for people to survive on long term. But I don't want people to be so frustrated by the bureaucracy and the lack of timeliness that they give up, because this is something you're entitled to. And there are easier ways to get the money now. As you mentioned in the earlier segment, folks can leave a phone number, they can get a call back. I'm hearing that they are getting calls back. So I just want to reiterate, don't give up, because it is something that you're entitled to and you need it.
What a game changer to have the whole callback aspect worked into the system.
It's amazing. It's one of those things where if you had asked me, you know, what are the 10 things that as an employment lawyer, I want people, you know, to have at their sort of, you know, beck and call, it's getting a call back, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing more frustrating than dialing and not getting anybody.
Jennifer Shaw is an employment legal expert with the Shaw Law Group in Sacramento. Thank you, as always, for helping us understand the latest challenges during the pandemic in this area.
Well, Randall, thank you for everything you do for the listeners, because they need this information and it's not always easy to find. So it's my honor and privilege to be here. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Jennifer. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Still ahead, the Sacramento Native American Health Center is hosting a Halloween. It's called Trunk or Treat, and it's at the big drive-in off Highway 50. We will have the details straight ahead. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Vicky Gonzalez has the day off today. So last Halloween, you'll recall, many were playing it safe and staying home because of the pandemic. Not everybody, but a lot were. There still wasn't a vaccine, and our only way of preventing the spread of COVID was social distancing and mask wearing. Not the Halloween mask kind, the other kind. Now, California has a fully vaccinated rate of 73%. In-person events are allowed again. And of course, based on your comfort level, trick-or-treating is allowed this year after it was discouraged last year, just before the winter surge, really kind of at the start of it. We have a bag of candy at home for the first time in a couple of years, waiting for the kids to come by. Tomorrow at the drive-in, you know, the really big one off of Highway 50, there will be something called Trunk or Treating. It's an event put on by the Sacramento Native American Health Center. It's open to all, family and kid-friendly, COVID-friendly. There is a hitch, though. It's sold out. Joining us now to tell us more about the event and the overall goal of teaching community is prevention is Youth Initiatives Manager John Brown. John, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Randall. It's so great to be here. I'm a loyal listener and supporter of Insight and CAP Radio, and wonderful to be here with you today.
Yeah, first we've met, so a pleasure to meet you.
Likewise.
Tell us a little bit about the Halloween Trunk or Treat movie night. How'd you come up with this idea?
So our department, the Community Health Department at the Sacramento Native American Health Center, is focused on prevention. And one of the things that we know in research is that suicide is the second leading cause of death among American Indian Alaska Native youth ages 10 to 24. And American Indian Alaska Native youth males ages 10 to 24 have the highest suicide rate of all demographic groups in the United States.
Wow.
So this is a real problem. And one of the things that we know is that what we call Western or settler kind of approaches to suicide prevention in Native communities have serious limitations. And one of those limitations is that our common methods of intervening individually in a clinical setting don't always work in Native American communities. You know, Native American communities are, especially in Sacramento, are isolated sometimes. Sometimes a lot of kids will be the only Native American kid in their classroom, or very often have no Native American teachers around them. And so social isolation becomes a big problem, a big challenge for Native American families. And so this is an event that allows people to come out and belong and be with other Native American families and hear positive messages. One of the things that we know in research is that when we destigmatize conversations about mental health, people seek help.
So, John, will suicide prevention or mental health messaging be worked in somehow to this event? Or is your overall goal to get people socializing again? And, you know, you're hoping to bring people a little bit out of their depression.
Yeah, thank you. So, this is a Halloween event. Come bring your kids dressed up in costumes. We'll have COVID-safe trick-or-treating around the parking lot. And we have two COVID-safe hospitality tents set up, one for elders and one for youth. Many of our partners, we're partnering with Shingle Springs Tribal TANF, and I want to do a great shout out to Rhonda Medicine Crow at Shingle Springs Tribal TANF for all of the great help that they've brought. But we also have partners like the Northern California Children's Treatment Center and the American Indian Education Programs from Elk Grove, Sac City Schools, and San Juan Schools. So this is an opportunity for Native American families to come out and be together. People will receive information and resources when they come. So they'll get everybody to leave with a packet of information. They'll be able to talk with social workers and counselors and elders while they're there.
Oh, great.
But in general, this is a movie. We're showing The Secret Life of Pets. It's trunk or treat. We'll have some games and some fun. And although we did sell out this morning, if somebody shoots me an email, I'll make sure they get on a standby list.
Because we mentioned that off the top, and it does sound like such a terrific event, I was wondering if there was going to be a waiting list. I imagine that's already growing.
It is. I have a number of people on it, but we're going to try to accommodate, we can fit as many cars as the parking lot will let us fit. And that's where we're right up against the max now. But if you send me an email to my email at john.brown@snahc.org, I'll make sure you get on a waiting list, and we'll make sure you get in to see the movie.
I love that everyone is invited too. So in addition to the other goals, this becomes somewhat of a multicultural event where you can share traditions and those sorts of things.
That's right. The Sacramento Native American Health Center is not exclusively for Native Americans, but our mission is to center healthcare experiences on the lives of American Indian Alaska Native families in the Sacramento region. But we treat people from all walks of life, and we welcome our Native American families to come out and join us, but we also welcome our allies to come out and join us too.
I'm curious how you came up with the movie to show.
Well, our friends at West Wind Drive-In gave us a list of recommended movies that are their most popular kid movies around this time of year, and that was at the top of the list, so it's a family favorite.
Right, yeah. I imagine Coco must be right in there, too.
Yeah, Coco will be, but this is the one we got.
So when you're not holding an event like this to spread the messaging that you want to, how do you get the message out there?
So Sacramento Native American Health Center has four departments: medical, dental, behavioral health, and community health. And each one of those departments has their own messaging, and we have a great communications team who tries to get information out there for the community. And we invite people to reach out to us on our Facebook page, on our website. We are always, in all areas, trying to create prevention opportunities in the community, and we welcome your participation. If I can throw in one last little thing,
sure.
Randall, we just broke ground on a new health center in South Sacramento.
Congratulations.
So, thank you so much. We will continue to keep our great Midtown location at JN 20th, but sometime middle of next year, we're under construction now, and sometimes in the middle of next year, we will have Sacramento's first Native American Youth and Family Center at 3800 Florham Road. And we're so excited about that.
Terrific. John, finally, just a quick question. I guess it's really not a quick question, but we don't have all that much time. I'm wondering how the past year has been for the Native American community and your efforts there with the health center.
The Native American community in Sacramento is incredibly resilient. And it's a unique community as Native American communities go because of historical relocation and some of the effects of boarding schools and things. But this is a powerful and dedicated community. And when we hold these prevention events, elders come out, youth come out, they support their elders. We have a great COVID vaccination rate. This will be a COVID safe event. Everybody you see that works, they'll be handing out candy, will be masked and vaccinated. And we want to make this a great event for our community.
All right. John Brown is Youth Initiatives Manager for the Sacramento Native American Health Center. All the details you can find on our website, as always, capradio.org/insight. If you want to get on that wait list, John, hey, thank you so much for spending time with us. Pleasure.
We love the show and we're grateful to be here. Thank you so much.
You bet. All right. That's Insight for today. Learn more about all our guests, as I said, capradio.org/insight. And you can always subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts. I do want a quick programming note, mention a quick programming note here. The Insight team is off all of next week. So in its place, we're airing the NPR show 1A. The Nave is inspired by the First Amendment, and each day you'll hear the same kinds of conversations that we bring you on Insight, just with more of a national perspective. And it's just for 1 week. So Insight will be back the following week on Monday, November the 8th. They deserve some time off. They've been very busy. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Pauline Bartoloni, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian, our digital team, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and engineer is Steven Starbuck. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I am Randall White, and it was a pleasure to be here today for Vicky. Make it a great day.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.